This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. You might not think to look for it, but one of the most vibrant Indian communities outside of India lies next to the New Jersey Turnpike. Early arrivals to the suburbs of central New Jersey faced opposition. Vandals broke and egged the windows of Indian businesses. But in the decade of the 90s, the Indian community in the town of Edison, New Jersey, tripled. And there's a strip of stores there where you can buy saris, books, ethnic food, and Bollywood movies. Like all the other immigrants who've preceded them, they're here to provide their families with more opportunities and better lives. Unlike earlier groups, though, the experience of Indian immigrants is largely suburban. Later in this program, Economics 101 on the importance or irrelevance of economic indicators. But first, Suburban Sahibs. That's the title of a new book by reporter Mitra Kalida, who describes the lives of three successive waves of immigrants from India. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. If you've emigrated from India or your parents or grandparents did, we'd be especially interested to hear from you. And of course, that would include Mitra Kalida. She's the author, she's the daughter of Indian immigrants and joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you briefly describe these three waves of immigrants you're talking about and where your family fits in?
Sure. I would put my family in actually the first wave of Indian immigrants. I call them the American Dreamers. They're folks that arrived as a direct result of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, which opened up U.S. borders. Most of them came for education. Most already had a bachelor's degree from India, but perhaps came over for a master's or perhaps a medical degree. In my father's case, he came over because visas were quite abundant, and he came directly on a visa that would lead to his green card. The second wave of immigration that I describe in the book are the brothers and sisters, perhaps cousins, of these families that they sponsor over. And they're much more of a blue-collar class of immigration that we're seeing. And the third wave are high-tech workers. And this is a more recent phenomenon that was something I followed. I started writing the book during the tech boom. So we had a lot of these high-tech workers who were coming in on a status of visa known as an H-1B. Mm-hmm. You're hearing a little bit less about them just because as the economy has declined, the need for so many computer programmers has dwindled, and actually we're shipping more computer jobs back to India, as it turns out.
And in reading your book, there's an important word, I guess, we need to know of what immigrant Indians call each other. Desi, is that, am I getting that right?
Desi, yes.
Desi, okay.
Right. Desi is essentially a term that a New York Times article once likened it to calling each other homeboy or homegirl. And it's a term that we use mostly for expatriate Indians, and it Desi literally comes from the Hindi for of the earth. So if you're of the earth of India and you happen to leave that land, we call each other Desi. Hmm. And folks like me are actually called ABCDs, American-born confused Desis.
I see.
Yeah, it's not flattering.
There was another set of distinctions, though, of a girl at a party was saying, well, there's some FOBs and some preppies and some thugs.
Right. I mean, it's a very...
FOB, fresh off the boat.
Fresh off the boat, which I think a lot of people often see as a slur, probably rightfully so, although the term has definitely been taken by a lot of Indian immigrants to distinguish between folks like me who are the American-born and those who are arriving straight from India. And, you know, in the course of reporting and writing this book, I definitely did see a divide between those two groups that plays itself out, as you describe, at a party or even in the school system, for example.
Well, give us some idea of the bigger picture. Where do Indian immigrants who arrive in this country, where do they come from? And aside from Edison, New Jersey and in Middlesex County, New Jersey, where do they end up?
The census figures showed more than 100% increase between 1990 and 2000. There are large populations in New York, New Jersey, and California. And through the 90s, I think you saw a lot of the high-tech workers settling in Silicon Valley outside San Francisco, the San Jose area, certainly throughout New Jersey, New York, a lot in the Washington area as well, where you do have high-tech corridors that were popping up across the country. Where they're coming from in India is a little bit more complicated. I mean, after 1965, you saw large waves coming from Punjab and Gujarat, which are states in the northern part of India. Because of the high-tech boom, though, you've had a lot more immigration from South India and the three states that people might identify with are Tamil Nadu, Andhra Pradesh, and Karnataka. Karnataka actually houses Bangalore, which is known as India's Silicon Plateau, is mm-hmm. what they call it.
Mm-hmm. There were also a significant number of Indians who came from the Indian diaspora, particularly from Africa.
That's correct. Actually, through a lot of the 1980s, a lot of Indians came through Africa because they were part of the exodus from Kenya and Uganda. You also have a lot who've come through the United Kingdom, and those are also, in some cases, they actually came first through Africa. So their experience in this country might be a few generations even removed from India. So it's been interesting to see how they still do shop in the sari stores and the Bollywood music stores along Oak Tree Road in Middlesex County, which is what I write about in the book.
And it's interesting, the first family you write about, that first wave, they first moved to Elizabeth, New Jersey, which is not an unfamiliar place for a new immigrant to this country to move, a gritty industrial city, once home to the Singer sewing machine factory. A long time ago. But it has since become a suburban phenomenon. How did that happen?
That happened, I think in your promo to the show, there was a teacher who talked about how she really welcomes Indian immigrants. Mm-hmm. I think that was from the movie Spellbound. And Indian immigrants definitely do value education. And I think the suburbs are a place that we kind of equate good schools, soccer leagues, and hopefully an easy commute to work, quite simply. And I think that the desire for education is what motivates a lot of Indians to come here. They look for good schools in the suburbs. They look for easy commutes, just like everybody else does. Their initial experiences in America in the 1970s, and for some, perhaps through the 80s, did start in cities, but nationwide, I think we've seen a decline of the city and a lot more economies being based in the suburbs, a lot more jobs being there. So this is a phenomenon, I think, that has mirrored what's going on in America.
So nothing special to Indian immigrants opposed to the time when they arrived in this country.
I would say that's true, but I think the education factor you can't discount among Indian immigrants. I think after India's independence in 1947, what the British left in India was a legacy of English education, and it also left sort of an importance on education. And I think a lot of folks come here for that opportunity, not just for themselves, but for their children. And that's something that all three of the families in the book, regardless of their economic background, very much voiced, that they wanted to be in Middlesex County because of its schools.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. We're going to begin with an email question from John Dunn. I travel cross-country via secondary highways, he writes, and I'm curious as to how it came to pass that so many small-town motels are operated by South Asians in rural areas of Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Missouri, far from any multi-ethnic urban areas.
That is an excellent question. I actually do write about this in the book. We talked earlier about the wave of immigrants that came from Africa, meaning they came from India to Africa, then to the United States. A large number of those Indians in Africa were actually entrepreneurs. They arrived in the United States throughout the 1980s, as I mentioned. Most of them are Gujarati, which is a region in northern India. And these motels have even become known as Patel motels, named after a very popular surname, the Patel. In fact, one of the family's last names in the book is Patel. So these Patel motels are basically run by large families. In my research, I found that chances are a cousin might own one and another cousin will own another. Mm-hmm. And they're very much entrepreneurial ventures. There's even a Asian American Hotel Owners Association that's based in Atlanta that serves, and they have a huge convention every year where all of the motel owners gather.
Sort of a Patel family reunion in a way.
It is. I think they let a few other people with different last names in occasionally, yes.
Now let's get a caller in. Susan's with us from Portland, Oregon. Hello, Susan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm married to a Indian man who immigrated from India about 20 years ago, and I don't have a lot of experience with other immigrant groups, but it seems to me that Indians as a whole are very reluctant to assimilate. Have you found that in your research?
Go ahead, Mitra Kalita.
I do often say that a lot of this book is sort of taking the assimilation story and debunking it, because by virtue of there being so many Indians in Middlesex County, New Jersey, they have created their own ethnic enclave. They have their own festivals, their own mm-hmm. shopping areas, not just shopping for their own sort of spices and clothes from home, but even their auto mechanic is an Indian. Their gas station owner is an Indian.
A cultural critical mass, if you will.
Very much so. And the numbers allow for that.
It's almost like they want to recreate India inside their home.
I think this is very much an example of trying to create a home away from home. And there's a lot of immigrants, especially the ones I describe in the book, where their memories are definitely where nostalgia reigns for that home that they left. A lot of it I can identify with, though. I mean, when my parents first came to this country, they didn't speak to their own parents for years at a time because they didn't have phones over there. And a lot of the high-tech world we live in now has changed that. But I think that when you are away from your family, and in India, as you probably know, the extended family system and community is very, very strong.
Oh,
so
yeah.
To come here and not have, I guess you have in-laws as well, to come here and not have any of that, I do think you try to create that on U.S. shores. And what we're seeing is maybe my father's generation wasn't able to do that as much when they got here, but the numbers are allowing for that, to have that critical mass, Neil, that you talked about. Whether this is a good thing or a dangerous thing, kind of remains to be seen. What's also interesting, though, is in the suburbs of New Jersey that there are a lot more examples of folks like these American dreamers, like the first family I talk about, for example, came here and definitely achieved economic parity with their neighbors. You know, they have a two-car garage and a wonderful home. What they're trying to achieve now is political parity, and I definitely do think that in order for Indians to have a political voice in this country, there is some element of assimilation that's going to have to go on, and it is going on.
Have there been any studies on the next generation, the grandchildren of the people who came? I mean, I'm only familiar with the children who are, the ones I know are mm-hmm, just mm-hmm. reaching 19 and 20.
Right.
And, you know, we haven't dealt yet with the whole love match versus arranged marriage. And my husband, who's very liberal and very Americanized, we're curious to see what's going to happen not only with our nieces, but also with their children. I mean, how many generations do they try to keep the children Indian?
I think that the example of the Indians from Africa might sort of provide a window into what we might see, because these are generations that, again, are several removed from India. Maybe they don't speak the language, but they are going to temple. They are shopping in these stores. Bollywood is mm-hmm. served as sort of a connector of a lot of Indians in the diaspora. And Bollywood, just for those of the listeners who don't understand, is India's movie industry, which is a play on the obvious, and it's one of the most prolific movie industries in the world. Turns out, I would say, thousands of movies a year.
And it's extremely important to the culture.
Yes,
very much.
Susan, thanks very much for the phone call.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we appreciate it. We're speaking with author Mitra Kalita about her new book, Suburban Sahibs. It's a close look at Indian immigration, particularly in suburban New Jersey. When we come back from a break, we'll take more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the lives of Indian immigrants and how they're different with each wave of migration and level of job security. You're invited to join our discussion. Does the suburban Sahib experience sound familiar? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Many of us got a glimpse into the lives of Indian immigrants in last year's sleeper hit movie, Bend It Like Beckham. The film chronicles an Indian community in the London suburbs. The central character is an 18-year-old girl, Jasminder Jess Bamra, who secretly plays soccer and is an excellent athlete. In the movie's climax, with her father's permission, she leaves her sister's very traditional wedding ceremony to compete in a soccer tournament and be seen by American scouts.
I didn't ask to be good at football. Guru Nanak must have blessed me. Anyway, there was a scout from America there today, and he's offered me a place at a top university with a free scholarship and a chance to play football professionally. And I really want to go. And if I can't tell you what I want now, then I'll never be happy whatever I do. You let her leave her sister's wedding to go to a football match.
Maybe you could handle her long face. I could not. I didn't have the heart to stop her.
And that's why she's ready to go all the way to America now.
And those bloody English cricket players threw me out of their club like a dog. I never complained. On the contrary, I vowed that I will never play again. Who suffered? Me. But I don't want Jesse to suffer. I don't want her to make the same mistake that her father made of accepting life, accepting situations. I want her to fight.
That from the movie Bend It Like Beckham. Our guest is Mitra Kalida. She's the author of Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. And we have an email question coming out of that clip of tape, Mitra. What did you think of the movie Bend It Like Beckham, asks William Babcock in North Little Rock, Arkansas, and does it accurately or inaccurately portray an Indian home in the Western world?
I've seen the movie 6 times, which I hope tells you how I feel about it. I very much enjoyed it. I think the clip you just played actually speaks to a lot of what this says about our community. You have a father that was not allowed to embrace what he wanted to do, was turned away by mainstream society, and decided not to do what he loved to do. You have a daughter that grows up and chooses to embrace that, and I think that's a little of what we're seeing when we talk about assimilation and sort of the anti-assimilation that perhaps some Indians in New Jersey have fostered by creating their own communities. I do think we're seeing pockets of, you know, teenagers and newer waves of immigrants really redefining the institutions that perhaps might not have opened up to them earlier. I mean, there's very day-to-day cases of maybe an Indian wearing a sari to the prom, to more extreme examples where you have Indians who are running for political office and redefining local politics and forcing institutions to meet them halfway. So I think Bend It Like Beckham is a great movie that speaks to some of those issues.
Well, speaking of politics, joining us now is Pradeep Kothari, who was sent to the United States by his parents to reform his ways. His family is one of the three profiled in Mitra Kalita's Suburban Sahibs, and he joins us now from his office in Woodbridge, New Jersey. It's very nice of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
When you left India, I read in the book, you promised your parents you would stay out of politics. What changed your mind?
Well, basically, I stayed out of politics for 17 years. I did not involve, even though I was so much involved in community activities in back home, due to the promise to my parent.
Mm-hmm.
But the day I moved from my old place of work to a new office where I moved, and I made a beautiful office, and the very first day, all my glass windows were broken with beer bottles and rocks and all kind of things, was garbage was thrown inside, and so I was really upset about it. I had a choice, and either to move again back to the different place or face the reality. And that's where I had to break my promise, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, since then, a great many more Indians have arrived in your community. How has that changed political life in Middlesex County, New Jersey?
Well, since that day, I become again the original what I was in a back home. I organized the business people. I organized my community. I educated them. I involved in a human relations commission in Middlesex County. I fought with the elected officials in towns and county and state and tried to fight back the bigotry and people who really are misguided, insensitive to the other custom, culture, or just they hate the somebody look different.
Speaking of bigotry, after the attacks of September the 11th, 2001, regrettably, more than a few South Asians were confronted by situations that went as far as, I think, at least one of them being killed in being mistaken for the people who were involved in the hijack of those planes. How has that changed things politically for you, Pradeep Kothari?
Well, before the 9/11, I was very, very active, and I'm still active in two very important body, one in a county level human relations commission and one is a council where I'm a board of advisor. Things have changed, and our argument for sensitivity and hate against the hate crimes has been a little bit diluted because the priority has changed, and we can understand the issue that the security of the people in this country is very important, and when those kind of crime committed by a look-alike people who are very similar to our culture and our look.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been misidentified, and many times some misguided people took law in their own hand and committed a crime. And that is what we are fighting.
Here's an email question that I wanted to put to both of you, in fact, and the subject line is untouchables, and this is from Richard Oba. Most of the Indian emigres are merchant class or better. How does the traditional Hindu caste society values mesh with American pluralism? Can a poor Indian expect to be able to blend into the Indian society in America? And Pradeep Kothari, why don't you go first?
Well, let me tell you, the untouchability is something most of the Indians hate it. There are people from those who are migrated and those who are educated. They do not approve those things. And our father of the nation fought very vigorously. And there are a lot of leaders in a religious community and philosophers also fought against that. And a person like me really don't agree with that. And my parents has worked very closely with those who are disadvantaged and those who were called untouchable, and I have seen when I was very young. And people who came here, they came with those kind of value. Of course, there are bad apple in every community. You cannot get away. Those people here also in this our great nation also, those who are far-right people, they don't think everybody is equal. God has not made everybody equal, and those argument is there.
Mm-hmm.
So we cannot blame those really conservative people who really pick those kind of issue.
Mitra, get a response from you on that?
Yeah, I mean, the issue of caste and I would say regional identity is actually something that divides Indians further in this country, meaning Indians from Gujarat versus Punjab versus Assam, the state that I'm from, versus the south of India. Caste, I actually have not found to be as much of an issue dividing folks once they are over here, except when it comes to one area that it has come up time and time again, and that's when Indians are trying to marry one another. I mean, there's a whole matrimonial industry for expatriate Indians on websites, through ads in newspapers and ethnic newspapers. There's even singles hours in many of these cities that have large Indian populations or in the suburbs as well. And there, I think that there is a lot of pressure for some young Indians to marry within caste from their parents, and that often surprises me, because in India, I'm actually sensing among my cousins who are still there, this doesn't even seem to be as much of an issue as I've found that it has been for the Indians who are now on U.S. shores. And there's some irony there in that to me of really hanging on to where you came from.
Being more traditional than the place you came from.
Right, yeah. Right. And obviously that's changed with as India has changed, but, you know, somebody who left India in the 1970s might still often have the traditions and the view of India in the 1970s and aims to impart that to their children, whereas someone who's coming from a much more cosmopolitan, liberalized, globalized India of the 1990s will likely have a different perspective on that.
Pradeep, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Can I add something to Mitra about it?
Go ahead.
What my saying is that every parent always preferred their children get married or something in their own culture. The reason is that that way they at least know each other and they don't have a physically any reason for disagreement or something. That is a human nature. I know my children is not going to follow that things because that kind of brought up is not there. They are given enough freedom to decide what is the right for them, what is the best for them. Still, the parent is always looking for their interest in their children, because they're brought up in certain things which may little bit create a problem in during their future life. And that's why some parent is resisting in an inter-caste marriage or something like that. But I don't think there should be that kind of should be a part of teaching.
Well, Pradeep Kothari, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pradeep Kothari is president of the Indo-American Cultural Society and the Indian Business Association. He's also a member of the New Jersey Human Relations Commission. He was with us from his office in Woodbridge, New Jersey. And we're going to continue with Mitra Kalida. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Sai, who's with us from Oaks, North Dakota.
How are you doing?
Okay. Go ahead, Sai.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
we
can.
Hear you.
Okay. Thank you for writing and chronicling the Indian immigrant story. I think it's pretty important that you, I don't know if your book incorporates the contribution of Indians to healthcare in America and around the world. I'm a physician in rural North Dakota, and we are helping with the rural healthcare system here. My boss is an Indian, and they've started a clinic system here called Southeast Medical Center about 25 years ago, and in the middle of North Dakota. And if you look around the country, you will see that a lot of rural healthcare is supported by Indian immigrant physicians and other South Asian immigrant physicians. And some of it is through a visa waiver program that Senator Conrad initiated. I think over the years, a lot of these communities have come to depend on physicians like myself for their healthcare. And I wonder if anyone's chronicling that, if you have any data in your book about events, something of that sort.
I do actually have a few paragraphs about that, because through the late 60s and 70s, a lot of these Indian doctors that you talk about were going to areas that nobody else would go. And that's what led so many of them to be in places like North Dakota or Kansas or Mississippi. And what they found was that they were one of handful of Indians in a town, let alone a region, maybe even a state. And I don't think that North Dakota has a very large Indian population. So I do think that that's something that is sort of a different immigrant experience to that which I write about in the book at large, which is in New Jersey, where there's so many of them. What's interesting is that we just had the Bend It Like Beckham clip with Perminder Nagra, who's the actress, and she actually has a recurring role on ER right now, and it's the first time ER, which is a very mainstream aims to in Chicago aims to present a emergency room, and for so long it just didn't have an Indian doctor on staff. So I think the fact that even on the television program we have an Indian doctor on staff kind of tells you now that it's entering the consciousness of a country to recognize that Indians have contributed so much to healthcare.
Sai, let me ask you briefly, do you have a family, and if so, do you plan to raise your children in Oaks, North Dakota?
At this time, my wife's actually going to dental school in L.A., but I might stay, when I'm older, I'm sure I would like to live in a community like this, because the one thing that medicine teaches you is human beings are the same everywhere. And the other thing which I literally learned is that rural communities really are similar in every country. If you look at the issues and problems facing, people in communities like this, it's the same as anywhere else. They depend on the weather for their, agriculture. Their health care depends on the availability of physicians. Prescription drug costs are so much that, it's a big problem. And I think it's the same issues And if the people, you know, in power look at the rural communities of the world, they'll see that there's so much similarity that there really is no reason for any differences. And I think I might, when I'm older, I'm sure I would, settle in a rural community because of the opportunities you get. You know, I can 30 miles is 30 minutes, and there's no question of traffic jams, and the air is pure, all the good stuff
here.
That's
not the case in central New Jersey.
No, it's certainly not. Cy, congratulations for your ability to drive that quickly, and thanks very much for the phone call.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk now with Hema, who's with us from Cupertino, California.
Hello. I have an interesting observation about the new generation Indians. I came to this country about 18 years ago, and what I'm noticing is, thanks to the Internet, the new generation, for example, my niece who came 2 years ago to Colombia, she already knew about the neighborhood, the bookstores around the school, the restaurants, the friends from her school in India who are living in the vicinity. I think this information helps ease the adjustment required when you're a new immigrant, and I think that's definitely a change for the better.
It's a very interesting observation, and we didn't talk too much about the high-tech workers, but the family that I profile in the book has such a different immigrant story from the other two. I mean, when they arrive in America, they're actually greeted with a limousine ride. They have, as you mentioned, they actually had looked up on the Internet about where they would be living, what it would be like. They also had a lot more access to television and American movies than the waves that came before them. And they also came from an India that was a post-liberalized economy that actually had McDonald's and many other brand names. And I think that also raises a lot of the consciousness. Now, whether the media that they have access to is giving the exact image of America and what it will be like, I mean, that's something that they didn't feel they completely had, but...
Right.
So how long have you been in Cupertino, Hema?
For about 18 years now.
And was it difficult to fit in there?
Yes. At first, I was totally lost in this country called America. I didn't know about the stores. I didn't know about, you know, the neighborhood. I didn't know if any of my friends were around in the area. So I think... you know, I had to really struggle to get myself adjusted in the society 18 years ago. And now, looking at the way things are, and I see that change is really pleasant, and I like this change.
At least in Cupertino, California, you didn't have to make the weather adjustment that our friend in North Dakota did.
No, definitely not.
Well, thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're speaking with Mitra Kalita. She's the author of Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. When we come back from a short break, we're going to wrap up our conversation with her and with you about the immigration of Indians to this country. We're also going to be discussing economic indicators in your town. How do you know when your local economy bounces back or goes down the tubes? Is there some marker that you look at that is a instant predictor of the economic trend in your town? Give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today is Mitra Kalita. She's the author of Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255. Email totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we're also going to be switching subjects and taking your calls on what the economic indicators in your town are. Is there something that tells you immediately whether the economy is doing well or doing poorly? Again, the phone number is 800-989-8255. Email totn@npr.org. And let's go to the phones. And this is Priya, who joins us from San Francisco.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for calling.
I actually was recently elected to the California Public Employee Retirement System Board, and I'm the first Indian American elected to state office in California.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I've been living here in the Bay Area for about 8 years, but grew up on the East Coast in Boston. And I've seen some really remarkable differences in the populations between East Coast, or at least Boston, Indian Americans, and those who are living in California or in the Bay Area. I think that those on the East Coast, at least in my experience, are much more assimilated into the general culture than those that are out here in the Bay Area.
And why is that, do you think?
I think it might be because of this enclave concept. At least where I grew up, there wasn't as much of a concentration of Indians in a particular area. Whereas here in Sunnyvale and Cupertino, you see very, very strong congregating groups of Indians.
Mitra Kalita, should you have gone instead of middle of New Jersey to the middle of California?
I think that a lot of the stories that are in the book could be written in California, and I actually did. There is a little bit in the book about California because the Indian experience there is such an important part of the Indian experience in America. I actually did my first book reading on Saturday in Boston, and it's funny because an audience member raised that very point that that they felt like they had sort of lived and grew up in isolation as an Indian in the suburbs of Boston. And I think this is a case of, you know, it depends on sort of what your vantage point is, that the experience of the Indians in this book growing up among so many Indians is certainly not the experience of Indians in North Dakota or in Boston or perhaps even in California. There might be Indians who are still, you know, the only Indian in their school, for example.
Right. I would like to make one other point, if I might, and that is that as I was growing up, I didn't notice a lot of Indians active in public service and politics, and I see a real growing trend in that direction among the Indian population.
Well, we certainly see the Indian man running for the governorship in Louisiana.
In Louisiana,
right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But not only just running for office, but also just getting involved in influencing politicians and policymaking.
Well, thank you very much for the call, Priya. We appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Okay.
Hi.
And before we leave you, Mitra, one question. In a way, you wrote this book. You started it on assignment in journalism school.
Right.
You've since moved on from that. But the assignment was, in a way, to find a new way to look at what you knew already, your own community. So what did you learn?
I learned a lot about myself, actually. I mean, I think I've seen reporting on the book as a lot of looking into my own family's experience and developing a whole new appreciation for the difficulties of coming so far from where you're from, and an appreciation for the idea of creating a home away from home. I think that, as I mentioned earlier, when you don't have contact with your family, to come here and to create your own version of that is really something to be applauded and celebrated. And now, as Priya mentioned, I think the challenge for Indians is to penetrate the institutions and really make ourselves a part of the fabric of this country as well.
Well, we appreciate the glimpse you've given us today. Thanks for
your
time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mitra Kalita's book is Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. She joined us from our bureau in New York.